When the bombs came, just before midnight, like the news guy said, I was underneath huge blankets in the fetal position, snug as a bug. Mum and Dad were in it with me.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Scottish writer Brian Connegan. The Bombs That Brought Us Together, published by Bloomsbury, is an all-too-relevant fable about language and loss. Regimes and refugees, and the forging of a common ground in the midst of real and perceived intractable differences.
Then it happened. They sounded far away, as if they were on the other side of Littletown, somewhere near the station. The bombs didn't thud the way I expected them to thud. There was no boom. There was no bang. There was no roar. They echoed like fireworks going off in the sky.
Brian Connegan and the Bombs That Brought Us Together on Arts and Letters.
The echo was so fireworky, in fact, that it teased and tempted me to get up from the fetal position and look out of my window, mouth open in awe at the beauty of Littletown's sky of so many colours.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with writer Brian Connegan, author of The Bombs That Brought Us Together. This modern-day fairy tale interrogates day-to-day living among war's inhumane effects, refugees, starvation, cruelty, and its counter-effects, friendship, integrity, love, and yes, in this case, even bombs.
I don't walk no crooked road. I don't walk no road at all. I just feel the river running over me.
The bombs seem just like cracks of thunder. Definitely not like bombs in the movies I'd seen or in books I'd read. The sustained attack lasted for 6 minutes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I wander in the maze through cricket singing day. No direction anywhere that I can see.
Brian Connegan, school teacher, former painter, decorator, and writer. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Brad. Delighted to be here.
I know you're a former school teacher, and we talked a little before about how you feel you pretty much just write books. Of course, they're categorized as young adolescent books. Tell us how you see your books influencing young readers.
I think I've always, in my own life, been a little bit politically charged. And as a teacher, I wanted to ignite debate and discussion around the literature that I was given school kids to read.
How did you consider the bombs working in terms of the narrative?
I think in the first draft, it was the threat of the bombs coming. So you might have had about 3 or 4 chapters of the threat of the bombs coming, then the bombs came, and then there was a fallout, and then there was more bombing campaign. But when I went to edit it, it felt to start with the bombs coming. It felt to open a book with the bombs happening and then just having the one sustained bombing campaign. It was hard to remain silent. I tried, I really did, but my breathing kept getting louder as I gasped for clean air. My body was trembling, adding noise to the silence. A hush came over Littletown. It lasted for 17 minutes. Under the blanket, I counted. 17 minutes of Littletown being dead as a dodo. A place fireworked to hell. I was now going to be living in a desert of rubble and ruin. My new home.
Your books deal with violence.
They do. I tend to write social realist books, influenced by, of course, the social and political zeitgeist, but certainly the sociological makeup also. You can't shy away from the violence that's around you. The sirens started up. Even under the blankets, I could see their blue, red, and orange lights illuminating the walls. Blue, red, orange, dark. Blue, red, orange, dark. blue red. The combination of the police, ambulance and fire engine sirens made a shocking crescendo of sound. Then the screams kicked in again, and every sound went up a notch, from shocking to terrifying. I squashed my face into the pillow and pulled up the sides so it fully covered my ears.
In this case, you have another land, old country, that's fighting a nameless war. Reasons are unclear, against Little Town.
In Little Town, where I live, people know something dreadful might happen to them one day. They realise that our regime has infuriated some other government, and that that government, specifically the one over the border in Old Country, doesn't like how certain things are done here. The way of life, the beliefs, the strangleholding.
Tell us a little bit about Old Country and Little Town. You said in some ways this was based on the annexation in the Crimea in 2014 and your notions of Europe East versus West.
Yeah, I think at that time in 2014, it seemed that Europe and the Middle East was on the cusp of something profound. You had the Arab Spring, you had the war in Gaza, and then closer to us, you had the annexation of Crimea and a civil war, basically, that was taking place there. But closer to home also, you had the Scotland referendum to leave the United Kingdom, and it was quite a divisive and polarising referendum. And it just seemed that we were living in these worlds of binaries.
You set up binaries in this book, Old Country, Little Town. You have Charlie Law, who's the lead character, and then Mercy. You have two lingos, two belief systems, but the two systems seem to be more similar than they are different.
But that was the real influence from the referendum. And now we're facing an election. We're always told that we're very, very similar. We're a united front, but within that similarity, we have to make these decisions, these choices, so we have to take a side. We have to take the side of the reds or the blues. We have to take the sides of the right or the left. And I think the book sets up these binaries because they're an extended metaphor.
You write,
they think it's all wrong, undemocratic, inhumane. Let's call a spade a spade. Old Country's government thinks Little Town is just plain bad. And Little Town thinks Old Country government is plain bad also.
So as much as you work with binaries, I think you also interrogate them.
I think that the way we see other nations and the way other nations see us, we don't fully understand, either culturally or socially. It sort of feeds a narrative to say that things are just bad. And again, it's about those binaries, Brad. I think it's about those two areas standing side by side, and somehow one has got to be better than the other. I mean, the cynic in me states that all governments are bad, corrupt, dispassionate and self-serving.
So you said the cynic in you thinks that all governments are bad, corrupt, dispassionate and self-serving.
And it's hard not to feel that way, especially given the 2 years that we've had in both our countries politically. It's a very difficult road to go down when you're in full support of the political systems. These bombs sounded like a combination of fireworks and thunder. Human squeals echoed. Cries became howls. Another bomb. Then another. And another.
I wander in the maze through cricket singing days. No direction anywhere that I can see. There's only rock and sky. No use to wonder why I'm living.
In this story, what do the bombs represent?
I think they represent the power and autonomy that big nations have over smaller nations. I think they represent the totalitarianism.
You also say they ignite a desire to disseminate what's right from wrong, but they bring death.
Ultimately, that's what they do, don't they? They bring fear, they bring control. And I think, as I said previously, they do bring unity. But in any war situation, it also brings corruption and opportunity.
Go stand beneath a lonesome pine, way up on a mountain high.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to author Brian Connegan as he talks about his novel, The Bombs That Brought Us Together.
I've been in this land low, and I've seen it change. I don't know where I can go, but I'll ride this road again. I've been in this land low.
Let's talk about the characters a little bit. Tell us about Charlie Law. He isn't that lawful in some ways. I mean, he has rules. He's so rule-based. And on the other hand, he wants to break them.
I think Charlie understands the difference between rules and laws. I like to write about teenagers, but I like to write about teenagers being teenagers, you know, with the same foibles and hang-ups and frustrations and desires that teenagers have, irrespective of where you come from culturally, socially. And I think Charlie has that. You know, he still has a desire for romance. He has a desire to better himself. And I suppose, unlike a lot of other teenagers that are reading books, he does love school. He loves the education process. He wants to succeed, and he also wants his friend Pav to succeed.
I rode this land way back when, and I knew there'd come a day. As it goes, there's always been, as it goes with what remains. I rode this land way back when.
As I was about to turn 15, my chops got rattled good and hard. Boom! Everyone and everything changed, and not always for the better. Pav and his family arrived a few weeks before the bombs came.
So tell us about the Dudas, Pav and his family.
Well, I think with the Dudas, I wanted to highlight this idea of the unrecognised immigrant, the immigrants that don't have a voice, those who work in unskilled and semi-skilled jobs, who earn a meagre wage, and essentially they're trying to live under the radar. You tend to find a lot of the times that in their home country, they were highly skilled professional people. And most importantly, they were people with a voice. And I think that's what I was trying to create with Pav and his mother and father.
This is also about fear.
Well, I think fear permeates the book. Pav's family are a good example because they fear kindness. They fear Charlie. They fear the relationship that Pav and Charlie have because they fear that alliance with the people from Littletown. And it's this idea that they keep their head down. They don't want to be recognised. They don't want to have their voice heard. They just go and do their manual labour and come back and exist. And Charlie's parents' fear is for what's happening with Old Country and the annexation of Littletown.
I rode this road down, but as far as it'll go, with every sight and sound, there's only one thing left for me to know.
Pav was about the same age as me and set to attend my school after the summer vacation. They came from Old Country.
I'm gonna ride on home to you.
Old Country? I know, right?
The notion of seeing nationality before humanity.
Absolutely. I mean, the discussion now, it seems to be about borders, about nationality, about immigrants. And I tend to be more interested about the person, the human. I don't consider the nationality to be important to me.
And one early evening, Pav and Charlie don't make it home before curfew. If they're caught outside after curfew, some very bad things can happen.
Yeah, I mean, they're taken away and interrogated and arrested, and their parents would also feel the brunt of that as well. So that's a big, big thing in their world, not to be out after dark, not to be wandering the streets, not to be going through the shells of the bombed places and things like that.
Right, so let's listen to this scene where Pav and Charlie, they don't make it quite home before curfew.
The pain of not reaching our block before curfew stuck in my head like a poisoned arrow. I didn't want to be annoyed with Pav, but I was a little bit. I'd spent my whole life avoiding trouble. Now we get in trouble for disobeying the dark rule. How stupid is that? The patrol pulled up just before we got home. Leave the speaking to me, Pav.
Okay, I say nothing.
The man leaned out the window, rested his elbow on the door, and gave us a big cheesy grin, teeth galore.
Good evening, boys.
We're just going home, sir.
That's what they all say.
Sorry for being late. It was an accident. My fault entirely.
Names?
I'm Charlie Law and this is Pavel Duda.
Duda, huh? You're not from around here, are you, son?
I live here.
Don't talk back, Duda. You know what I mean.
He moved here recently, sir, from old country.
Am I asking you, Law?
No, sir.
So shut your trap then, okay? Old country not good enough for you, Duda? Old country throw you and your family out, did they? Speak up against someone important, did you?
They left because of...
Am I talking to you, Law?
No, sir.
So button it then, mouth.
Sorry, sir.
So what's your story, Duda?
No story.
Tell us about the unnamed security force who finds them after curfew. This guy's smiling. But in this case, it's almost a sinister sneer.
That represents a sort of new style of military policing that can come out of civil war, for example. And you've got security guards elevated into these positions of power. And invariably, this character is about the abuse of power. So you get a sense that they're driving up and down these streets in this town night after night looking for confrontation, not trying to avoid it.
You know, I was just thinking, run.
But if you run, you might get shot.
And they know who they are.
You get the idea also that the streets are deserted, so you've got these two little boys and there's no escape for them. So, can we go home now?
Now he's asking if he can go home.
Would that be okay?
Now he's asking if that would be okay. Sorry to break it to you, but you two clowns are going nowhere. There's someone who wants to meet you two boneheads. So sorry to say, you won't be setting off together into the night.
Who wants to meet us?
Get in.
So this is the moment the boys meet Little Town's underworld.
Yeah, this is the moment that the big man is exposed. So you get that sense that these sort of military policemen are incredibly corrupt and are controlled by the underworld.
This is an underworld. You paint it beautifully. We think of the underworld, which is often pretty much in the light. In this case, it is not. He's in this foul warehouse, and it's disgusting.
In my head, it sounds a little bit cliched as well, but in terms of the whole place being destroyed, you know, there's not many places that you could find that would protect you and keep you within the shadows. So it was this sort of dirty, murky warehouse that I had in mind to place the big man in his empire. The place it took us was foul. Nasty dropping water fell from the roof. It wasn't even raining. My ears stand up. It reeked of salt, damp towels. The stink was so bad.
See that door over there?
Yes. We watched him drive off into the night again, searching for stragglers. We were alone. The door faced us. I looked Pav directly in the eyes. I could tell he was thinking the same as me. If we went through that door, my ears stand up when I hear that. We might not get back out if we didn't open it. And my whole life felt like the sky when the sun goes down. Something worse would happen to us. My whole
life. All right, so a little bit of Dante?
Yeah.
They're already in how many circles of hell? I don't know, but they're definitely into the meat of it here. So Pav says,
I know like this, Charlie.
Tell me about it.
This never happened in old country.
Don't mention old country in here, okay?
No old country. My mouth zip.
And try not to show you're scared.
But I terror scared, Charlie.
My mind was swimming. What's that smell? Who wants to meet us? Are we going to be hurt? Will they hurt Pav instead of me? Am I in trouble because I'm Pav's newest pal? Is this a setup by Pav and his old country mob? Do Mum and Dad know I'm here? My whole life felt like
the sky when the sun goes down. Boy, Charlie likes his lists.
He does, he's a lister.
His lists of rules, his lists of questions.
Yeah.
His lists of do's and don'ts.
But this goes back to his idea of education and study and self-progression. And he writes all these little lists for himself. I think it elevates his personality and his character, actually.
It seems to be about control, too. I mean, he can't control anywhere he is, but he can make a whole lot of lists.
And he's sort of quirky. His lists can be quite quirky as well.
So tell us about this scene. It's, to me, at least, reminiscent of the German SS during World War II. And they're going to see a character, a thug, basically, who's been running Little Town. He's a dictator type. He ran it before the bombs fell. He seems to have more of a tenuous position, but at the same time, he's still very feared.
You pray now you're gone, another chance will be rest upon your face. When the morning time does come, and you're still unsure what you desire.
The figure they're going to meet, the big man.
You fall down onto your knees. This is your kingdom, these are your dreams. Ain't that right?
He's a compendium of all those thuggish, despotic, authoritarian characters that emerge before, during, and after wartime.
Pack my case and took me by the arm. As an alarm, all of my golden friends.
The big man symbolizes the corruption and greed in the society now.
Let it bleed from me. That's just another invitation.
Let's meet the big man.
Inside the door was a desk. A computer sat on it, along with a lamp and a phone. On a chair sat a man, longish hair, lush beard, dressed all in black. His head was gigantic, his belly colossal. The big man was exactly how I pictured him to be.
They meet this shady character, the big man. What happens?
The big man sees an opportunity to lavish them with what they want, to praise them, to make them aware that he's the stakeholder and he's a gatekeeper for things that they need now in Littletown. And of course, it's all a ruse, isn't it? It's about him corrupting those kids. So this is the thing that I wanted to achieve with the book. I don't know if I have or not, but it was certainly something that I was interested in.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with the author Brian Connegan about his novel, The Bombs That Brought Us Together. At the heart of the novel is the difference in language, how language makes and unmakes us, distinguishes us, sets us apart, and how words can bring us together, like bombs.
Boat, boom. Dish towel, boom. Lampshade, boom. Shoelace, boom. Tank, boom. Grenade, boom.
Tell us about these words followed by the bombs.
I think it was just this idea that Charlie had a strong desire to teach Pav all aspects of the language, but he understood that language can distort many things and make us wary of each other. And we know that it seems to treat those who can't understand it with a great deal of suspicion.
Here, the teacher in you comes out in Charlie's character.
My job would be to tie them all together with my own diagrams, verbs, and innovative teaching style. Easy. When my eyes opened from the troubled dream, that was my day's mission.
Any other comments about teaching? I know you're writing full-time now.
I taught for 15 years. I taught here in Ireland for 7 years. I think as a teacher, as a secondary school teacher, high school teacher, you're always faced with reluctant readers, and you're always faced with essentially a lot of boys who are reluctant readers. And every time I wrote a book, I always had images of these young kids over the years that I taught who hated books, who hated the words, who hated reading. And I could see myself in those kids because I wasn't a high achiever at all when I was at school. So I wanted to write books with short chapters that was engaging enough for kids to read and follow and be entertained by. So every time I write any book, the teacher in me is always there. It won't leave me for some reason. My mission was to get my hands on a lingo book with lots of exercises and diagrams in it. A book that was simple to follow for the basic speaker, Pav. A book teeming with so many words that it would seem as though they were being fired at you from 100 rounds a second Uzi.
And there you're using language as a weapon.
Absolutely. And obviously using the metaphor of the gun was important considering the situation that the kids were in.
When we talk about books here, you contrast war with knowledge, the love of books.
The love of language. I never had it when I was Charlie's or Pav's age, but I certainly wanted the character to have it. It becomes a little bit didactic in a way, I suppose. Maybe subconsciously I wanted that to be the case. My characters to tell the readers, books are important, language is important, knowledge is important, because it gives you power. It's great for your esteem.
Books are so important, yet they're often burned.
Libraries are destroyed, they're closed down. But you can burn as much as you want, but you cannot bomb or burn knowledge. And you cannot eradicate the desire for knowledge. I hadn't been out in the streets for a while, except for taking the bus to and from school. The park was different this time. The seesaw had been fixed. It seethed and sawed once again. The merry-go-round spun again. The six swings swung another day. All the broken glass and booze bottles had been swept off the ground. I put it down to the locals and collective spirit. I'm pretty sure the little town regime and the rascals would have just left it to ruin. Maybe old country troops helped.
I do like this moment of possibility. Merry-go-rounds are spinning. Swings are swinging, and much has been attempted to be cleaned up.
Yeah, you've got to have a sense of hope, and I wanted it to be hopeful in that sense.
Life, away, good down, and life, it's so strange, I know you don't know.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters. Nothing for Breakfast.
Good man, get glad, don't find
Leopold and his fiction.
I've been in this land low, and I've seen it change. I don't know what I can
Amy Joseph Anna. Ryan Sauters.
And I feel like a river that has lost its way.
And the incomparable Nick Devlin.
There's only rock and sky. No use to wonder why.
For their amazing soundscapes that fill the silence of tragedy's aftermath with warmth and hope. Thank you to actors Nick Devlin and Leon Kochaya for lending your voices. Thanks to Mr. Chris Hickey, who recorded the show. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Brian Connigan, whose YA novel allows us to find humanity in the bomb's brutality, empathy and understanding in the rubble, and steadfast friendship in the ruinous outcomes of war.
I don't walk no crooked I don't walk no road at all.
For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Albert Einstein. Peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding.